Good morning. In preparing for this morning, I was thinking about what I wanted to tell you about Centurion Ministries and what I wanted to say today. I saw this as an opportunity to describe my spiritual journey that has led to the formation and development of Centurion. I hope that you don't mind if I do so. The scripture I've chosen today is John 12, verses 24 to 26. Truly, truly, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. He who loves his life loses it, and he who hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life. If anyone serves me, he must follow me, and where I am, there shall my servant be also. 30 years ago, I didn't hate my life in this world, but I sure didn't like the life that I was leading. I was 38 years old. If we were to use, as strange as it might sound, a gasoline gauge in an automobile as a metaphor for my life at that time, then I was extremely on full, at least as far as the things of the world were concerned. I was a corporate executive making good money, had a nice home in the suburbs of Philadelphia, and drove a beautiful Lincoln Continental town car with fine leather upholstery that I miss to this day. And I traveled the world, especially in the Far East, on business. But internally, my spirit was on empty. I felt hollow. I had lost all interest in my career, business success, and all of its worldly fruits had lost their meaning to me. I was disillusioned and lost. I felt I had been living a very selfish and shallow life. I was serving or helping no one but myself and my employer. Whereas once upon a time I was filled with corporate ambition, I had lost all passion for such a career. Something was really missing. From the outside, my life may have looked like a rainbow in that I had all the worldly accoutrements, but in reality, my life is what a rainbow is, vapor, having no real substance. At the same time that I was yearning for a different life, one that had purpose, meaning, a sense of authenticity to it, my Christian faith for the first time as an adult was beginning to take root within me. Throughout most of the 1970s, for the first time in my life, I actually looked forward to going to church. The Paoli Presbyterian Church, about 25 miles west of Philadelphia, and the preaching of its pastor, Reverend Dick Streeter, were fast becoming the secret treasures of my heart. The constant themes in Dick's sermons were wash the other's feet, serve the real life needs of others, and have faith and trust in the Lord. Commit your way to the Lord. He will lead you out of your own personal wilderness and show you the path that he has chosen for you. This is what I was searching for. This was the truth that I was yearning to find. I saw Reverend Streeter's life of ministry as one that really touched and changed many lives, his parishioners, the people in the community at large, and mine in particular. My life was touching no one, as far as I could tell, at least not in any deep-seated, significant, or life-changing way. For the first time in my life, I was devouring the gospel. It seemed like the words of Christ were my new meat and drink. They stirred me deeply and fired up with me a whole new passion, a passion to lose my life and yet at the same time gain a whole new one, to be that grain of wheat that dies unto itself by falling into the earth so that I can, by doing so, bear at least some fruit for God. And finally, after a year or two of internal conflict and frequent sanity checks, the words of Christ gave me the conviction to let go of my life in the secular world, to surrender all and follow him. As crazy as it seemed or sounded to my friends and family, to go where I thought he wanted me to go, and that was to the seminary, in order to prepare for the Presbyterian church pastorate. So in 1979, I sold my house, I drove up to Princeton in my precious Lincoln Continental, and moved into the seminary dormitory. lest you think I was a total Jesus freak who went off the religious deep end at that time. I'm here to tell you that that's not the truth. I could not part with that car. For the first year in the seminary, it remained parked incongruously outside Brown Hall, the dorm I resided in. Unfortunately, later on, I had to get rid of it since it was only getting 7 miles a gallon. By the way, when I told the general partner of the consulting firm that I worked for in Philadelphia that I was leaving the business world and going into what I thought was the ministry, the church ministry, that is, his first words with me when I picked him up off his office floor, "Jim, I didn't even know you went to church." That tells you how much of a double life I was leading. I can't tell you how, well, I had one foot in the corporate world and the other in the church world. I can't tell you how liberated I felt and how at peace I was in my own heart and mind when I marched off or drove off to Princeton Theological Seminary, knowing that I was finally pursuing the singular path that I believe God was calling me to, the church pastorate. But as it turned out, God had something else planned for me that was very different than church ministry. And believe me, it was not by design, nor was it a master plan that I had somehow conceived. It was just something I stumbled into, having absolutely no idea what was waiting for me around the corner. All seminary students are required to do field education assignments. You have one right here among you. My field education work took me to Trenton State Prison as a student chaplain. This meant that for 2 full afternoons a week during the 1980 and 81 school year, I would go from cell to cell on 2 tiers, visiting with some 40 inmates a week. If they wanted to talk, it was up to them. If not, I'd go on to the next cell. They were locked in their cells, and we student chaplains would stand outside their cells during the visit, safe against the world. We were to be their friends, not to save their souls. Anyway, one of these men was named Jorge de los Santos. He was in the 5th year of a life sentence for a Newark, New Jersey murder. I didn't know it at the time, but my life, already undergoing drastic change, was to be turned upside down once again. This time, by a 35-year-old Puerto Rican and former heroin addict, raised in the harshest of Newark's housing projects. Jorge was married to a full-blooded Cherokee-American Indian woman named Elena, who lived in their Newark housing project apartment. Through the fall of 1980, each afternoon I would arrive at his cell, and he would insistently and compellingly speak of nothing but his innocence. When I would return to my seminary sanctuary from the hellish afternoon rounds in the bowels of the prison, I couldn't shake his persistent cries of innocence. They haunted me. Could they be true? Was he really innocent, or was he conning me, as my friends advised? I always had a blind faith in our criminal justice system. The thought of an innocent person in prison for the rest of his or her life was beyond my comprehension. If there was such a person, I thought, he or she must be one in a million. But what if it were true? What if he were innocent? What could I do about it? I had no experience whatsoever in our legal system. I had never even been called for jury duty. Besides, we student chaplains were warned very clearly. They all say they're innocent. We were told to ignore such proclamations and to steer our conversations away from that. Don't be naive by believing them. Don't get involved in any of the inmates' personal or legal matters. We were strictly forbidden to do so. If we did, we would be immediately fired and reported to both the prison and seminary administrations. I got fired. And I got banned from Trenton State Prison because I decided to get involved with Mr. De Los Santos. By Christmas time, I had obtained a copy of his trial transcripts and studied them carefully. This is in 1980. The case came down to, who do you believe? Do you believe the star witness for the prosecution, his name was Richard Delasante, who told the jury that De Los Santos had confessed the crime to him when they were together in the jail tier at the Essex County Jail. Or do you believe Mr. De Los Santos, who testified on his own behalf that he was innocent and testified vehemently as to that? I found it very hard to believe that any human being at that time, my mindset was, how could anybody be so despicable as to intentionally send an innocent person to prison with false testimony? I believe that Jorge was innocent. After much prayer and personal angst, but filled with an inner joy that I could finally, finally serve somebody in my life in a meaningful way, and also deeply believing that this was perhaps, hopefully, a divinely inspired mission, I set about to help him in some way. I told Jorge the day before Christmas in 1980 that I had a Christmas gift for him and for me. The gift was this. I was going to take a one-year leave of absence from the seminary and work full-time throughout 1981 to see if I could move the ball forward towards freeing him. I told him I would spend that entire year hitting the streets, investigating the case, finding a great lawyer for him, and forming a defense committee to raise and disperse money in our effort to free him. That Christmas visit was one neither of us will ever forget. It was for me because it gave me a sense of mission which I had not had before. That was his gift to me. In a hard nutshell, here's what happened. Everything had come together by the summer of 1983. On July 26, we freed and vindicated Mr. De Los Santos when a federal district judge ruled that Richard De Los Santos' trial testimony, quote-unquote, reeked of perjury, and that the trial prosecutor up in Essex County knew that his star witness had lied. After the 1981 calendar year leave of absence, I returned to Princeton Seminary, graduated with a Master's Divinity degree, but believing the innocence of two other men in Trenton State Prison, who Mr. De Los Santos introduced me to, I said to him, "Are you telling me everybody in this place is innocent?" He said, "No, but I got two more for you." I did feel the hand of God was calling me for a call within a call, if you will, and that was to work to free what I call the convicted innocent. It didn't hurt that although broke, my parents came into some extraordinary income at that time and gave each of us three children a tax-free gift of $10,000, which I considered manna from heaven. And also as a sign from God that maybe, just maybe, I was on the right track as far as he was concerned. I set up and incorporated Centurion Ministries, named after the centurion at the foot of the cross, who is told by Luke in chapter 23, verse 47, RSV, that centurion looked up at the crucified Christ and said, "Certainly this man was innocent." Since then, we have done our best to answer the Macedonian call for help from numerous convicted people throughout the United States and Canada. To date, we have freed 44 of them, 42 men and 2 women, including 2 Canadians. I look forward to meeting those of you who can come to the mission fair in Fellowship Hall after the service and perhaps give you a better understanding of the work and organization of Centurion Ministries. I appreciate, I really do, you allowing me to explain to you or express to you this morning how Centurion Ministries got started. For some reason, this is what I felt compelled to do when I was preparing my remarks yesterday. Thank you very much.